Excuse me, at this time today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect. Thank you, ma'am. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone on today's Council Ops call. We have Tony Holmes, Ray Fassett, Wolf-Ulrich Knoben, Ron Andruff. From staff, we have Glenda Saint-Géry, Ken Bauer, Rob Hogarth, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. We have apologies from Avery Doria. If you can just remind everyone to state their names when speaking. Thank you. Over to you, Ray.
Thank you very much. Okay, Ray Fassett here, our first meeting of the year of the GCOT. So I did not, again, send out a formal agenda for today's meeting, but I think we're all pretty much up to speed on what we'll spend our time on today, which, again, remains talking through this concept of council reps having to abstain, and then what impact does that abstained vote have on the final outcome being, right now, it defaults to, in effect, a no vote. And should there be options available to change that? So with that said, there's been some discussion. I sent out an email this morning. I think Ken did a wonderful job going back internally, getting us legal advice as we asked. I interpreted Dan's response from what Ken explained, and I think Ron had some comments, and I responded this morning. Is there anybody else that has comments on this? Or where we're at now. If not, I can give a summary.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Give a summary?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so basically, if I understand it right, and Ken interject if you want, staff legal advice is that a conflict of interest, which is the issue here, can't exist with ICANN. Why? Because, and different than board members, council reps do not have a fiduciary responsibility to ICANN. So therefore, a conflict of interest can't exist upon a vote taking place at the council level. Now, I read Ron's point, though, and I thought he made sense. Okay, well, we can't just put our head in the sand. We are hearing that there can be issues of a conflict, and let's not get caught up in semantics, but there can be an issue of a conflict by a rep where the rep feels they have to abstain their vote. That's reality. So while I can agree with Dan's position, and I think he's probably correct, that there can't be a conflict with ICANN, the question remains where is the conflict and what is the conflict about? And whose burden is it to resolve the conflict? Those, to me, are the key questions. And if we agree that there can be a remedy to avoid the conflict, can these remedies be put into the rules of procedure?
Go ahead. I'm finished. I'm sorry. I thought you were finished.
Now, and then one last thing is, assuming the whatever we may come up with in the rules of procedure are then followed, and the abstention still exists at the council level, should in those instances the denominator be changed? So those are the basic questions as I understand them to be. But now, Ron, please go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say, Ray, I agree with the piece you sent through just a few, prior to this call. I think that's the nub of it. I agree that there's a conflict cannot exist within ICANN, and I'm glad. I was very grateful for your your synopsis on that, because that is a bit of a confusing issue. Obviously, there were always, and from what we heard from Steve and others, these conflicts arise quite regularly. So, I didn't see it as you saw it, in the sense that it looked like we were just trying to be to obfuscate the idea that conflicts exist, but clearly conflicts do exist. But there isn't a conflict with ICANN per se; it's a conflict with the issue, and I agree with that 100%. So this is what we have to talk about.
Right. So one assumption I also gathered from Ken, and again he can correct me, which is why I'm bringing it out, is it doesn't seem to me. I mean, it seems pretty clear that per the bylaws, I'm not mistaken, that each council rep is allowed one vote and only one vote. So us looking at the concept of proxy is probably not the path of least resistance.
This is Ken. I would make a slight just comment there.
Yeah, please.
Because the in that paragraph 8, it does say, except as otherwise specified in these bylaws. And as I tried to note in my...
Did we lose Ken?
We did lose his connection. He should be back with us momentarily.
Okay.
In between, Ray?
Yes, Wolf.
One question, Wolf. Well, does he mean, you know, there's a counsel advice, you know, there's a legal counsel advice, you know, that there is no conflict of interest on ICANN level? Does this mean, is their intention to say, okay, then there is no need for any kind of abstention? Or what does he mean, so for me?
I don't mean to cut you off, but... I'm kind of listening to what we've been discussing all along, and I'm not quite comfortable to make that broad stroke. I think, from what I'm understanding, there can be reasons for an abstention at the council level.
And then Ray, this is Ken Bauer. I don't know what happened. The phone just bam, and I was off.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. So comment that I was making had to do with this clause that's in there that says, except as otherwise provided in the bylaws, each member only gets to cast one vote. In many sections of Article 10, where it says except as otherwise in the bylaws, it also says, or the GNSO Council operating procedures. And I think I remember Samantha Eisner telling me at one point that something that's in the GNSO Council operating procedures can modify these sections that we're talking about here. So two things I would say. Either A, the GNSO operating procedures can modify this paragraph, or it would be an easy thing to simply add to the bylaws a phrase that says, except as otherwise specified in these bylaws or the GNSO operating procedures. Because that's done in many other places in Article 10. It's very common. So I would say we should, at this current time, we shouldn't accept that the bylaws prohibit one person, one vote.
No, but I was thinking, that sort of off-the-cuff phrase, path of least resistance, is it really realistic that we can change the bylaws?
I would say at the moment we shouldn't rule that out.
But could someone clarify? This is wrong. Could someone clarify for me? One person, one vote, proxy doesn't work. I would think that one vote would be proxy. Would mean I would give that one vote to someone else within my organization to make that vote, which I think we're referring to as also the alternate. Can someone clarify the distinctions between alternate, proxy, and one vote?
I could try. Because Ken again. So let's assume for the moment that the bylaws, what it means when it says one person, one vote, is a councilor can only register a single vote for a particular issue at any time. That's what this paragraph 8 says. What Dan was saying is, here's another option. You could bring somebody else who is not a councilor in from the stakeholder group and or constituency and have them cast the vote. Now, you say, well, wait a minute, they're not a counselor. Right. And that's where we go back to this other bylaws language that I cited, where it says that it is possible under certain circumstances, that we'd have to change the bylaws to add this to the level, to the set of circumstances, but you could have somebody else come in as an alternate. You'd register that person with the secretariat. They would participate in the discussions. They would vote. And then when that situation's over, they would go away, and the other counselor would come back, take his or her seat. Does that help?
That makes a lot of sense. So why wouldn't we want to do that? I mean, in terms of changing bylaws, this seems to make sense to be a logical bylaw change.
This is Ken again. I would make this point. to bring in an alternate, I think, to vote raises a lot of just technical logistical issues. You've got a set of counselors who know each other, they know their names, and they work with each other and all that. Here comes a brand new person in who maybe is not known to the council. Do you have introductions that have to be made? Do you have statements of interest and declarations of interest to be make sure get put into place? Secretariat has to be notified who this person is, and dial in instructions that there might be email list this person has to become a part of. I don't. It just seems to me that bringing in a non-counselor into vote or to discuss and then vote on a matter vis-a-vis somebody who cannot perform their duty is more difficult to do than a proxy vote, which would be, you know, I just say to this other counselor who's already on the council, and by the way, he or she would probably be voting the same as the other people in that constituency or stakeholder group anyway, and so they carry on the discussion, and then that person registers the vote of the person who couldn't be there. It just seems like I think we should have both procedures in the rules, and when we talk later about what I've constructed, I would make them hierarchical. I would say, you know, go down the list of remedies in the least difficult procedure until you remedy the problem. And if you can't, you go to the next step. And I put them both in the procedures. But I would think that it would be easier to execute the proxy than it would this other alternate thing for reasons I've given. So let me stop
there. In practice, implementing the proxy is easier than the alternate.
So this is Ron again. If I understand that correctly, then when we talk about proxy, we have, you know, in the case of the BC, we have two representatives on the council. So let's assume one of them is conflicted, and so, but again, in principle, these two representatives should be voting the will of the constituency. So one may be conflicted because of, you know, some business relationship with that particular issue that's being discussed. So the one who is unconflicted in that case would be able to take the proxy vote of the of not the conflicted individual per se, it's the proxy vote of the BC. Does that make sense? So the BC itself is saying, we're voting in this direction, so we expect you two to go there and make that vote. One of them puts his hand up and said, but, you know, I am actually consulting this particular company that has, okay, so now we have a conflict of interest. Declare the COI and ask for, file a document that says that the unconflicted counselor will vote the two votes on behalf of the BC.
This is right. Ken. That sounds right to me.
So that's a reasonable thing, because now it comes back to the one person, one vote story. So what we're saying here is that it's two votes, two reps, but they're voting the will of the constituency. So if we have documentation in place that could be filed, you know, the standardized documentation that allows for that circumstance, then that conflicted individual doesn't register as an abstention. He registers as a confliction, a COI, and then that vote then will move by proxy, and they will be approved by, you know, someone within our constituency, let's say the president, the chair, whatever, because we're now reconstructing all of those things, that says this is approved by the constituency, therefore we can go ahead.
This is Tony. I think that actually works quite well now, because most of the charters for the constituencies, if you look at them, they have texts that bind their representatives now to follow in votes the desire of their particular constituencies. So if that is in place, then I think Ron's suggestion works particularly well.
Yes. Hi, this is Aubrey. Can I add
something? Oh, Aubrey's here.
Yeah,
Aubrey.
Sorry, I joined late.
Good. Please, go ahead.
I think even in the case of a constituency or stakeholder group that didn't have that binding, in other words, but that did it on a vote-by-vote basis, in other words, a conflict has been announced, and within the group, and therefore the constituency slash stakeholder group says, so in this case, is there a decision of the group on which way to vote? So even a group that didn't enforce party discipline but left people, you know, free to sort of vote as they thought was best for the constituency. could still have a process that would make it work.
This is Ken. I want to support that comment, and we discussed that, I think, too, at our, one of our last conference calls.
Yeah,
that,
and
that,
I think
yeah.
I'll just throw it back in. Yeah.
Thank you. I think that's right. I agree with that, too.
Well, one thing I've learned in this conversation, this is Ray, is that regardless of, well, we've kind of narrowed it down to two primary tools or options that we're thinking about, which is one, a proxy, and two, an alternate, being able to cast an alternate. But and both of those options will require some modification to the bylaws. Is that correct?
This is Ken. I would add one additional remedy that we keep skirting around, but we I think it could work.
Okay.
As somebody comes forward and says, "I've got a problem. Let's just whether it's a conflict of whatever it is, I can't function as a counselor on this matter and in voting in this capacity." One of the things that could be done is the constituency and or stakeholder group could direct the counselor how to vote and say, okay, you have a problem somehow, and so what we're going to do is tell you what to do. And we'll do that in writing, and all you got to do is present that in writing and say, this is what I'm being told to do. My conflict has now been absolved. We know that there are certain circumstances for attorneys with professional obligations where that wouldn't work, but I think there might be others where it would. And so that might be another one in the hierarchy of remedies, and maybe we can talk about what I proposed. I also in that email, I laid out a whole scheme for how this might be organized, and there might be a hierarchy of remedies.
I thought right? That would be first one, right? Would that be the first?
That
one?
Would be among the first, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and for some people that wouldn't work. And then we would go to the next one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can actually walk through that. That if you want me to summarize, it's in that last email that I sent to the list.
Yeah, go ahead. Walk through it. Walk through the steps that you came up with.
Am I changing the subject here? Was there an item on the table that we wanted to settle first?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. If you guys have access to that summary email that I sent on the 27th, in which I laid out what Dan had said and so forth and so on, and several of you responded to it. At the bottom of that, I started a set of paragraphs.
I'm sorry, Ken. Excuse me, Ken. I'm looking at the. It was the 18th of December.
Yeah, that's the last one I have too.
Yeah,
18th of
and
December.
Sent to Ray and the GCOP members. It's called Legal Review Update: Abstention and Proxy Voting.
Yes, that
and
is
it discusses the conference with Dan Halloran.
Yeah,
Rob, I'm sorry.
I stand corrected. It was the 18th.
Okay. I just want to make sure we're on the same page.
Yeah, thank you very much. I just this morning installed Office 2010, and my email stuff looks a little different. And it shows at the very top the wrong date. Okay, I got
you're
it.
You're at number 3, A through E. I think that's where you're going, right? In that email.
It starts. The paragraph starts. Another thought I had after considering this matter holistically.
Yeah, fine. Okay,
and then
that's
I
all,
have
that's
yeah.
All.
Then okay. I have three items. All right. So what I was thinking about is, if we looked at the procedures from a very high level, the first thing we might do is say, look, and this was recommended by Dan and Liz back in the 2007 era. We should have something in there which talks about the duty of counselors. And there are two specific paragraphs. We don't need to review the text now, but there is text available that talks about the need for active participation and being responsible and all that sort of thing, right? So counselors are supposed to perform their duties and be available and understand what they're to do. All right. Now, second item, though, says, look, conditions could occur that prevent the fulfillment of a counselor's responsibilities. And I've cited what I think are the two cases where this can occur. First is an incidental or temporary absence. And then I made a note that maybe extended absences should be handled via some other procedure, which we haven't written yet. But let's just, for the time being, we can ignore that.
Mm-hmm.
The second case is an abstention. And abstentions come in two flavors. One is volitional, which I've sort of rechanged it. But we used to call it voluntary, but it's volitional. And the second one is obligational. The first one is where... we had a list of cases, you know, I'm not up on the issue, and I'm going to abstain because I haven't read all the material, or I missed the last three meetings. Those would all be volitional abstentions. And the second one would be obligational, meaning, you know, I've got one of these conflict of interest situations that we've talked about. Whether we call it that or something else, that's what we're referring to. So I'm looking at the procedures, how we might attack them. First, here's your duty. Second, we recognize you might not be able to fulfill your duties. And three, here's a bunch of remedies in order that might apply to different of the conditions that have occurred. So the first is electronic voting, which we, I think, currently call absentee voting. That would remedy a certain class of situations in which a counselor can't perform. The second would be a voting directive, which I referred to a minute ago, provided by the constituency or stakeholder group to the counselor. If that doesn't work, the next one is...
Well, slow down. I'm sorry. So the voting directive, this is Ron, I just need to make sure I understand. The voting directive means that the stakeholder group or constituency says, I want you, our representative, to vote this way. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And then the third one in the hierarchy or in the logic tree would be a vote proxy to either the House NCA or another of its counselors. And I made a notation, of course, assuming that the organization can and will produce a consensus position that enables that remedy, which we think would be the case most of the time, but it might not always. And then the fourth one in the list would be this naming of a temporary replacement or alternate who is empowered to stand in for the counselor, which is the one that Dan referred to that we would need a bylaws change for, but he's willing to do it. Now, that one does not require the organization to establish a consensus position, right? It probably just needs to inform the stand-in what they should do. Or maybe they would say, look, you're standing in, and we really don't care what you do. You can vote however you want. It doesn't matter. You are going to, though, you're going to represent this constituency. We're not going to have an abstention. We're going to try to remedy that condition. And then the last one is all the above fail, and the counselor abstains, and we decrement the denominator. So what I'm doing is, what I'm trying to do is to provide kind of a set of lesser to more extensive remedies, and we would always do them in that order.
Now, question here, Ron. This is on the D, the constituency names the temporary replacement, the alternate. Why would we not try to bind that alternate to the constituency's consensus position? Why would we say, I don't quite understand why you said that wouldn't necessarily need a consensus position, and I just don't see where a constituency or a stakeholder group would send someone to vote on something when someone else can't vote and say, just, you know, whatever, however you feel on this thing. That just sounds kind of antithetical to what we're trying to achieve here.
This is Ken. All I was trying to say is it wouldn't be a requirement. You wouldn't necessarily write that in because it's not needed. If the constituency wants to remedy the abstention case, right, the person who's got the conflict,
right,
and we can't do it by proxy voting for one reason or the other, in fact, if the constituency could develop a consensus position, then it would use proxy because it precedes, it's the lesser remedy in the list. And so what I'm assuming is they can't develop a consensus position, right?
Right.
But that doesn't mean they can't bring in an alternate and tell the alternate what to do. But we don't have to say that in the procedures. All we have to say is the constituency wishes to bring in an alternate to act in or stand in for the counselor who wants to abstain. And I would presume that the constituency or stakeholder group would instruct that alternate what to do, but we don't have to tell them that, right?
Right.
It's not required.
Right. I mean, from what we've heard and our understand is that there are some instances where the constituency just isn't able to come up with a consensus position, whether it's short notice, whether it's just that they give their reps autonomy in some cases to simply act as they think should be the best interest of the constituency on their own volition. You know, so I don't think we would want to hard code that in there.
The premise on all of this, of all these remedies, is that the constituency and or stakeholder group would under most circumstances not want to ever have an abstention registered where their vote isn't counted. And so we would give them a whole series of remedies that they could execute so that an abstention does not occur. But if all of that fails and an abstention does occur, then we say you decrement the denominator.
I agree. This is Ron. I agree with the idea of a list of remedies. That makes sense. But I'm just concerned about what's in that list. I'm uncomfortable with the fact. I never feel comfortable when an individual in a bottom-up consensus-driven organization is choosing to make his or her own decision on something. It just doesn't jibe with what we're trying to achieve as a organization.
Oh, I agree with that, Ron. But by the way, just so you know, I'm in complete agreement with you. To me, the question becomes, you know, what can we mandate from the ROP level to the House level? I mean, we have to recognize, I think, that the idea is each House is to have some autonomy, and each stakeholder group or constituency is to have their own autonomy. They're to take responsibility for their involvement with ICANN, and I'm with you. I think that drives to where my reps are going to be accountable to the group, not what they believe, but from where we sit in this position, I think our role can only go so far as to what we mandate upon the houses or the constituency groups.
So if I understand you correctly, then what you're saying, Ray, is that the idea of taking D and trying to beef that up to say that it would, you know, that alternate would vote the consensus position, you're saying we need to keep that loose?
I think so, because if they get the consensus position, I agree with Ken that they'll just do C. But I think Aubrey has even explained in the ALAC, that in the ALAC, you know, it's to them, it's not the, it's
actually
not
MC,
the,
MC,
yeah,
MC,
maybe you can explain it
ALAC.
Better. NCUC, I'm sorry, yes,
right,
the NCUC.
NCSG and NCUC, not ALAC. But yeah, I totally agree with you that people aren't supposed to be voting their own, but very often you will find a split community. And so when Ray says they're accountable to the community, they most definitely are. But sometimes, especially when you have a community that's split on an issue, basically, then the representatives basically are, you know, use your view to represent one of the sides, because there isn't a consensus. And especially within something like the non-commercials, and the bigger, more diverse we get, the less likely we'll be at a stakeholder or even an interest group / constituency level to have a consensus on all positions or to force it. And so that's when I think within a bottom-up, the notion of representative, and if your representative isn't representing you in the overall, then you get rid of that representative. And it's not that there is 100% mandated vote at every turn being the only way to be bottom-up. I mean, I very strongly support, you know, legitimacy only through bottom-up, but I believe there can be a certain amount of trusting your representatives to represent the views, and that's why you have a bunch of them, et cetera.
Yeah, so go ahead. I'm sorry.
I beg your pardon. I just want to respond to Aubrey. I think that, you know, it's one thing to say you just get rid of your rep, but it's another thing to actually do it, because it's just the amount of disharmony and discord it can create within an organization just trying to remove somebody who's not fulfilling the expectations. It's so problematic that most people would prefer to defer that and say, you know, let's just let him run out his time and then he's gone and we'll get somebody new in. But the bigger issue is, it comes back to, if stakeholder group or a constituency cannot reach consensus, is that not the time when there should be an abstention?
we just can't get consensus, so therefore we abstain from this. So that would, you know, that would almost fall into an obligational abstention.
Why do we need more than one representative from stakeholder group then?
Well, I always thought, my understanding is sharing workload and having a little bit more brain trust from the organization there to chew over ideas within the GNSO council.
Well, here's what I'm thinking. This is Ray. I think the NCUC likes the way they go about things. This is, Aubrey has explained it, and that's the way, that's what they want to do as a stakeholder group. It's not our place to say, no, you can't do it that way. If we want to put in a, if we feel that there should be a mandate in the charters that the reps are to at all times be representing the consensus position, for example, of their group, then that goes to a different work group. This is something Chuck Gomes recommended. If we want to go down that path, that's Olga's group. We could ask Olga to look at that and see if there should be language required in all of the charters. But that's not our position.
I would vote for that personally. Sorry to interrupt, Ray. I would support that idea of looking at that, because I think it's important that, you know, the representatives again are not individuals who make their choice. And I understand what was just said, that, you know, sometimes that's the tiebreaker is that individual. But on the whole, I think that the organization of ICANN and the GNSO has to be one where it's consensus. It's about the individuals who are at the GNSO bringing forward the feelings of the body, not of themselves.
Okay, well, we can put that as an aside. Let's double back and ask whether we have consensus amongst our group, whether we should go to Olga's team and have them look at this as something operational that should be put into the charters.
Aubrey?
Yeah.
I'm certainly not against asking them to look into the issue. I'd be uncomfortable saying that we have a consensus saying that that should be the way it's done.
Yes, right. That's a very good point.
I agree with that,
yeah.
Aubrey.
Yeah, that's correct.
I agree with that as well.
Yeah,
no problem.
Yeah. Right. Our consensus position would only be, do you want to look at this?
Yeah.
Ray, this is Ken. May I make a comment?
Yeah, go ahead, Ken.
In some ways, I think I'm a little bit responsible for this detour. It was not my intention in that parenthetical clause that says does not require that the organization establish a consensus position. It was a note to you guys on the team. Mm-hmm. It was a kind of a parenthetical note to us, mm-hmm, that this particular remedy wouldn't so require that, right, because we're saying that the one before it does require it, and if you can't produce that, then we need another remedy for the situation in which you can't. I would suggest that we not put that language into any specific rule, which doesn't mean that therefore that at that point I think it would default to whatever the charters do in fact say. Right?
Yeah,
and if
right,
the charters say we constrain our members, then that's what happens. If the charter doesn't say it because that's how they chose to do it, then it's silent.
I'm sorry.
Can I add something on that one?
Yeah, just before you do, I just want to be clear. So you're saying in C we're not silent, but in D we are silent, right?
Yes, because I think
okay,
that one of Dan's issues around proxy from the 2007 document, in fact, now that you point that out, I realize I used the same artifact in the document, right? I used brackets and stuff. One, I think, does belong there, because I think to use proxy, he was insistent that there was a consensus position that could be used to make the proxy happen.
Understood.
In the case of the alternate, I don't think that was a
Understood.
Requirement.
Understood. Aubrey, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. Even having the opinion I do about, you know, not forcing party discipline on some notion of consensus, and I'm still not sure what notion of consensus we have, I am fine with having a set of rules that sort of say, if there isn't consensus and the person is not there to vote, then there is an abstention, then you fall through. And I'd be fine with leaving out that proxy, you know, proxy, give it to someone else to figure out what to do with notion. the one that we're silent on. So,
well, that C or D? I just want to make sure we're clear. We're talking about C.
I think D. Wasn't D the one that was optional? Or
D
silent?
D is the alternate one. D is the alternate.
Right. That's the actual proxy one.
No, C is the proxy one.
Okay, I don't have it in front of me.
That's okay. Proxy is when an existing rep has more than one vote. And
right, but that vote is constrained.
Consensus vote.
It's consensus constrained.
Right.
I'm fine with leaving out any option that is not consensus constrained. So even though I believe that in the general state, the representatives need not be constrained by consensus at all times, I do think that it's fine that in the absence or the conflict of interest, that vote be constrained by consensus.
Oh, I see the distinction. That's a good distinction. Interesting.
And as when it's the stakeholder group saying, we've got six votes, damn it, and we want to use all six of them because we've got consensus on this thing and it's important to us, then fine. They should be able to express their sixth vote. But when it's, well, you know, Joe's missing, we don't have consensus, so why don't we give, you know, Jill the vote to, you know, she thinks she needs to do with it. That one I don't think is necessary.
That's an interesting perspective I didn't think of. But let me throw this one at you, okay? And this is for discussion, what's to stop a group, constituency, stakeholder group, whatever, from saying, well, we don't want to do A, B, C, or D, so we're just going to abstain? And then, therefore, the denominator gets changed. Is there anything preventing that?
So what you're saying is that they would use this tactic as leverage?
Right.
And you're asking the question, is there anything preventing the constituency or the stakeholder group from using that leverage? Is that the question?
Yeah. How are we going to hold them accountable to actually do A, B, C, or D? Because here's what I'm thinking. Here's what brought it to mind. If we say that in both C and D, a consensus position is required, if we say, come right out and say that, and then all the group has to say is, well, I'm sorry, we can't get to a consensus position. C and D are out by default. Therefore, we have to abstain.
Well, that's a good argument. And I can support that argument for the rationale that there isn't consensus in D, which is the alternate. And that's probably the logic for it. That's a pretty clear statement. That does protect the ability for someone to lower the denominator on an important vote.
Right. Okay, so I'm kind of in favor of being silent, keeping the alternate option of D, and being silent that it has to be a consensus position.
I support that. Ms. Ron.
My next question would be, okay, but even with that said, okay, what are in the rules of procedure to hold the group accountable that they have in fact tried these A through D options versus saying, well, we don't want to do any of these options, so we're just going to default to E? Ken, any thoughts on that one?
What's the benefit is what was going through my mind, Ken. What's the benefit of defaulting?
I came up with am I on mute? No. I came up with one sort of scenario, and I think I've applied it to one of the contracted party sides. Am I talking here?
Yes,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
We can hear you.
Thanks. You know, we're a situation, it could be, I think it's kind of unlikely. I'm trying to think of under what circumstances would a stakeholder group prefer a reduction in the denominator to exercising its vote. And so I understand the question, Ray, you're asking, which is, okay, fine, we have an abstention case of some kind, right, or a failure to perform, and we're looking, and we want to make sure that all these remedies are followed rather than just given lip service to, so that, in fact, we don't default down to this this last step. And so why would – I can't really think of any good reasons – this is the gaming issue, right? I can't think.
Well,
of
how do you ensure that E is rare? That's it. Now, I mean, we all agree that it should be a rare instance. It could happen, but it should be rare. So, what do we put in here to ensure that it is a rare instance, rather than hoping it's a rare instance?
In the duty of counselor section, we could also put duty of stakeholder groups and/or constituencies, right? We could put something in that says, these organizations own the votes, and they have a duty to exercise them. And they do that through their delegated counselors who have duties to prepare themselves and to act in that. So we could take that approach, in which case we make it clear to the constituencies and stakeholder groups that they have an obligation to exercise these votes and not abstain. Now, I'm not sure how much further we can go. One thing we could possibly do, right, if we talk about it, we could remove the scapegoat at the end. There is no decrement the denominator case. In other words, we've given so many good remedies here under various circumstances, consensus, no consensus, you know, electronic vote. There's a whole lot of things you can do, direct account, that one of them must work. And if you do abstain at the end, guess what? We don't change the denominator.
I kind of like that idea myself.
I like that idea, too. That feels right.
Okay.
Anybody else like that idea? Wolf? Robbery?
It's Tony. I think it's
Tony
idea as well.
Okay. Thanks, Tony.
I think we have to go back to those who came to us at the beginning saying there had to be the possibility of decrementing the denominator to make sure that they felt that at least one of those remedies made it possible for them to agree to that. Personally, I see no reason not to agree to it, but I think we'd have to go back to the people, I guess it was the IPC, who said they absolutely had to have that.
Well, no, they didn't. They said that at first, and then when we talked through it and explained our position that we thought the burden needed to be resolved at the stakeholder group level, they saw that. And they agreed with that, too. So we said, well, if there were options or remedies that existed at the stakeholder group level for you to relieve yourself of that conflict, would that be satisfactory to you? And they basically, I thought I heard them basically agreeing. Yeah, agreeing with that.
Well, and the other part of it is that, you know, I don't know if we invited them to come and give us some advice, and we've taken that advice. I think the key here is to not so much go back to a couple of individuals or to one constituency and say, does this fit, but rather we should try to frame this and then take it to the OSC and have them review, because at the OSC level, you'll have IPC constituency review.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is that taking away this decremented denominator is a very big step forward for us, and I think that with the other, as Ken just quite rightly said, with these four, there are four ways you can resolve this problem. So we're not going to allow anyone to game the system by decreasing the denominator. As has well been pointed out by many, the number of votes are too few. So, you know, if we take away that leverage, it forces people back to the table to figure it out. And now that we've kind of agreed, in loose terms, that we don't force a consensus position on the alternate steps up and makes that vote, I would expect that what will happen more often than not is that we'll have consensus, and that the one rep will assume the vote of the other for the proxy vote of the other representative to make the vote. I would think that would be what we'll see most of the time as a result of four options.
I think that's well said. I like the four options myself. I think they could work in practice.
Can I ask a question about the four options? The fourth option, the silent on consensus one. Does that one fit with what Dan had said was required? I'm being confused. Because I thought that proxy was okay in the case of consensus, but that there was questions about whether it was okay in the case of there not being consensus.
I think as it pertains to proxy, Dan's position is that there has to be consensus within the constituency to even go there on a proxy, to even discuss it. That's a requirement. But when we're talking about alternates, that's not his position. Now it is not necessary that there needs to be consensus within the stakeholder group.
This is Ken. I don't think I specifically asked Dan that question, and it didn't come up in our discussion. Here's how this discussion actually took place. Dan has some reluctance around using proxy voting.
Mm-hmm.
The word proxy conjures up legal things. I don't really know all the background of it, but you could tell that back in 2007 there were some positions around, can we do something else? And in the end, what was done was absentee voting, and that took care of the problem at the time, and then it died, right? We've resurfaced it, and in my process of going through all of the things that they said back in 2007, we've met most of the issues, and we have met all of the issues that were identified, and Dan, in as much as told us, Rob and I, that on our conference call. He's still a little reluctant to use proxy voting, and that's when he said to us, here's another option. We could do an alternate. And I said, well, I don't think you can do an alternate because you have to be a counselor to vote. And he says, well, not if we execute this bylaws provision, which is already there. And we would have to tweak it a little bit to make it fit this condition, but he seemed perfectly willing to do that. Now, since he didn't rule proxy out, and I think it's a good solution, I'm hoping we can persuade him that it works, and we've dealt with all the issues, and I'm going to come back to that in a second. And he seems okay with this idea of an alternate. I thought they might work together very nicely in sort of a hierarchy, right? So that's how I positioned it. And we don't have conclusive agreement with Dan on this yet, but this is where we're moving it. I mean, it's where we're sort of pushing it a little bit.
So we don't know if Dan's going to take the position that in order to invoke the alternate, there needs to be a consensus position.
I don't think it's since it's not. The condition in which that alternate already exists is a case where I'm on the council and I go to the board, right? And because I'm now on the board, I can't vote. Somebody else can step in and vote for me, but there's no constraint. There are no rules. There are no regulations that say when I step in or when somebody steps in for me, that they have to vote. There's nothing. It's silent on that. So
okay.
I assume that he would not impose that restriction in the alternate case.
Okay, let's make that assumption for this. Go ahead, Aubrey.
Yeah, I'm still confused, I guess, and it's perhaps because I don't understand what we mean and the scope of alternate. Is the alternate only someone that comes into a meeting for 5 minutes at the vote and sort of says, okay, I'm in local councilor as an alternate, and I cast this vote? Or is the alternate some sort of longer-term notion that says, on this particular issue, I've removed myself, and therefore the role of Councilor 5 from, stakeholder group 3 will be played by for the whole duration of the topic? I don't understand what we mean by alternate. Or somewhere in between those two things.
Let me try on this one. I think that falls within the duty and burden of the rep and the stakeholder group. So it becomes when the rep makes it known. If they're already in the midst of some degree of discussions on it, and then the rep decides, okay, I better let my constituency group know about this before the vote comes. Well, that's the way it goes. If the rep decides that, okay, I see this coming, I'm gonna get out of this one early, then the alternate would step in and be in there for a longer period of time.
And so would participate as a council member on that topic from that point until the topic's resolution.
I think so. That's my interpretation.
This is Ken. That's my interpretation also.
And then where we'd have to be careful about, because it's a good question, is that what we don't find is the person that is claiming the conflict is still, you know, getting into the conversation, which we could probably envision that happening. So we got the alternate in there, and then so somehow there would have to be a procedure that if it's Joe Smith, well, Joe, you can't talk about this issue.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of little devils wandering around.
This is Ken again. This, incidentally, I just wanted to say a couple of the things that were on Dan's mind when he expressed his reluctance to use proxy voting. Were things like this. You know, back this apparently this was done way, way back in the DNSO or some period of time, because he's been around a long time, where one person would come to the council with six votes, right? I'm here, and I'm now going to vote six because I've been proxied all these votes. He wanted to make sure we didn't do things like that, and that we tied down the procedures. That proxies, when they were done, they were incidental. They were not lasting. In other words, I can't say, well, you know, I'm going to proxy all my votes for the month of September to so-and-so. So we would tie the procedures down in a way that they would be, it would be incident-specific. You know, this would be like a motion before the council or something. They would have a beginning and an end. It wouldn't be lasting. We might impose this rule, which actually I credit Rob Hogarth for coming up with, which is to say, when you proxy, you may only proxy one vote to one councilor at a time. So let's say, this I think works out arithmetically. No councilor can execute more than two votes then, mine and the one that I was proxied. So if you had three abstentions that needed to have proxies in a stakeholder group, like, and since you have seven people there, you could actually get that done, right? And if you get to a situation where there are so many people who have to have their votes proxied, you don't have quorum. And we have rules about how quorum would be managed, and proxies do not count toward quorum. So I think we can mitigate against all of the concerns that legal had back in the 2007 time frame by just really tying the procedures down like I've been discussing.
I think those are good, excellent points. Those are very good points. And here's another scenario I've been thinking about too, is why we need D. Is if we use the BC as an example. No, the IPC, let's use either one. Let's say both their reps have a conflict. Okay, so there's no ability to proxy to one to the other. They have to go to D. So we have to have that D in there, the ability to name an alternate. All right, so if we're basically in agreement that these are the four steps that we would take out E and see what happens later on it. There's a huge drafting job here from what the things Ken just discussed about, you know, nailing down sort of the finer points as he just mentioned, drawing out the four points maybe a little bit more clearly or with more detail. There's quite a bit of work here to get it into a position of getting it in front of the OSC.
This is your dutiful policy staff speaking. This is Ken. I would be happy to continue in this sort of drafting capacity.
You took the bait.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
It's a fascinating subject. I'm really enjoying working on it with you guys. And all I really tried to do in this email was to bulletize it so we could grab onto the ideas.
You did very well.
Yeah. And so my first question to you is: do you like the general approach of the duty, the things that might prevent the duty, and then the remedies?
Yes, I do. Anybody else? I think Ron dropped off. Avery, you okay with that approach?
Yeah.
It's reasonable.
Okay, then what I would do, that was important to me because I didn't want to go and write a whole set of procedures using that construct if you guys weren't too keen on it, right? The other way to do it is to say, here's a problem, and here's the three remedies. Here's another problem, and here's the three remedies. Here's another problem, and here are four remedies. And the remedies are the same in many cases, right? So what I was trying to do is to say, look, here's what you're supposed to do. Here's what happens. Here's the things that might prevent you from doing it. And here are a bunch of remedies in hierarchical order that you go through one by one. And so if we're okay with that, I like it, I will start to write these procedures using that model. Now, if we don't like it after it's all written, yeah, we'll write a different way. But at least we think at this point that that's a pretty decent way to go about it.
I do. Anybody object? Okay.
Good. Well, then I'll start work on that. And that'll actually be very helpful, because I think if Dan actually could see the real procedures that might be in the GNSO Council rules,
sure,
then he'll be able to really think about them more critically, and then we'll know exactly what bylaws changes we'll need.
Exactly. I think that is being fair to Dan by taking this next step. One other question I wanted to ask you, Ken, and others, is I know there was some back and forth, or it seemed like there might have been some back and forth on even using the term conflict of interest.
Thank you. That was going to be my next question.
Okay. I'm wondering if we can change it to personal conflict of interest. Someone has a personal conflict of interest.
Why is that different than conflict of interest?
To distinguish that this conflict of interest is not with ICANN. So we acknowledge there cannot be a conflict of interest with ICANN by a council rep. We acknowledge that. That doesn't mean that there can't be a personal conflict of interest.
This is Ken. Essentially, you're asking a nomenclature question, right?
Yeah, basically. Just
what
so
what
we get
can we call it so that it doesn't, in Dan's mind, the term conflict of interest, I guess in legal terms, refers to a specific kind of fiduciary problem, which we don't have here.
Right.
And so, we're just looking for a different, I called it a professional dilemma, but that didn't sit too well. Maybe we can come up with some other term. Personal conflict of interest would be another way to do it, I guess.
Except that by including conflict of interest, if conflict of interest meant fiduciary conflict, then personal fiduciary conflict could be equally as confusing.
How about just personal conflict?
Personally conflicted.
Personally conflicted, yeah, something. We'll work on it.
Right.
But, yeah, that's what I wanted to address was the – I don't want to find us getting on a path of semantics. You know.
What I did in this little bullet session to sort of avoid it is said, look, there are reasons to abstain which are volitionally and obligationally created. So in a sense, an obligational abstention is another way to look at a personal conflict, right, without using that term.
Well, here's one of the things I'm just kind of thinking about, so I'll just say it out loud. We don't need the lawyers that are in the IPC coming back and disagreeing with Dan that, yes, it is a conflict of interest. You know? Now we got lawyers, and it happens every day. Lawyers disagree with each other on terms. So, why aren't you calling this a conflict of interest? Well, because it can't be a conflict of interest. Well, yes, it can. No, it can't. Yes, it can. No, it can't. So it's I'm trying to find a middle ground where we keep conflict of interest, the term, but now describe it, give it a description. It's a personal conflict of interest. Maybe we have to put in a definition. What does conflict of interest mean? Conflict of interest does not mean a conflict with ICANN.
Right.
You know.
So one could say I have a non-fiduciary conflict of interest.
I'm not a lawyer, but I could hear Christina saying, but I do. It is fiduciary because I have a fiduciary obligation to my employer.
Ray, this is Rob. If I can just interject, I know I've been silent most of the call. I think the fundamental issue here is that if an abstention is going to be triggered, it needs to be for a significant and substantial reason. And that's where we sort of found ourselves in that big C conflict of interest discussion. As long as we can come up with some nomenclature that does reflect that it's not just because I'm feeling bad today or, for some other minor reason, then I think we'll be okay.
All right. I have to think about that one. I thought that we were sort of landing on, well, we don't want to get in the middle of whatever the rep feels their conflict is. If they feel they have a conflict, then, you know, we're just going to take them at their word. They think they have a conflict. Who are we to say they aren't?
This is Ken, and I think, let me try this one more time. I think we can avoid dealing with the term conflict of interest. I think it'll work out, and here's the reason why. We don't decrement the denominator as a result of our most recent decision as a team, right? So
yeah.
When I take the denominator out, now basically I come forward and say I am going to abstain on this matter. And somebody said, well, why are you going to abstain? Well, you know, I might say something like, I have an obligation to abstain.
Christina says I have a conflict of interest.
I have a conflict of interest, but we're not going to write it down that way. We're going to write it down as a obligational abstention.
Well, here's my point. I'm not articulating it well. We have not addressed the issue then that the person has a conflict of interest. They'll come back to us and say, well, that's great, but you have not addressed the issue that the reason I have to abstain is because I have a conflict of interest.
Is the reason important, or is it the fact that I need to abstain? I think what I heard Christina saying is, I have a professional reason that I must abstain. Whether it's called a conflict of interest, I don't think was really the essence of her point. What she then followed up by saying, and Steve agreed, was, and when I have a professional obligation to abstain, you can't treat it as a no vote. If you do that, you're in essence putting me in a position with my own ethics and my own professional obligations that makes me essentially a liar, right, or whatever. And so the answer to that is, we're giving your organization multiple remedies to execute, which can be done, and now you can abstain, meaning recuse yourself,
mm-hmm.
but we won't actually register an abstention because we have a remedy for it instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll tell you, I hear all that, and I'm not against the spinning and the terms and all that. I'm just saying that, in effect, we're siding, and we should just then come out and say it, that there, as far as the rules of procedures are concerned, there cannot be a conflict of interest. I mean, if we're avoiding the term is all the way around, then we should just come out so everybody's clear.
I don't understand what you mean, Mrs. Opry. I'm confused again.
Well, we're saying that a scenario to abstain are all these different reasons, and here are the remedies. Here are the remedies to resolve the abstaining. But somebody says, but you... And none of these, by the way, remedies allow the denominator to be changed. So someone says, well, you have not offered the ability for a conflict of interest to exist. That should then, therefore, change the denominator.
True, but what we're saying, in essence, is we believe, this is Ken, we're saying that we recognize that there is always a remedy available, always. If you have a consensus in your constituency, you proxy vote. If you don't have a consensus, you name an alternate. There is always a remedy available, and therefore there should never be a case where you have to abstain on the vote. What you do is recuse yourself from the discussion and the vote, but somebody steps in. Either a proxy person steps in,
yeah,
or an alternate steps in, and that can always be done, always.
Right. Well, then,
I like that obligational recusal.
Yeah, I like it too, by the way, just so I'm clear. I'm just trying to foresee here. Let me try to question a little differently. Should we just come out and say that there, to us, there is no scenario where there can be a conflict of interest?
But I thought we were handling conflict of interest, not that there couldn't be any.
If we were, we'd be using
the
term.
Conflict of interest, but we have these four remedies for avoiding your conflict of interest.
No, we're not. No, because we're doing everything in our power to avoid using that term.
Well, this is Ken. Let me take a shot at it, if I might. We're calling conflict. I think Dan's position is the term conflict of interest has a narrow legal definition, by not using the term, well, we are assenting to his narrow interpretation that says conflicts of interest at ICANN means a specific thing legally, and it means that the people who are claiming it have a fiduciary responsibility to ICANN, which they do not. Therefore, they can't use that in their, that term. That term is reserved. It's a keyword. It has a specific legal meaning, and the case doesn't exist. So ICANN Board of Directors has it, but the counselors do not.
All I'm saying
so we need
is
to find,
document
we need to
that.
Find,
hmm? All I'm saying is document that.
Well, I did say what he said in the...
No, I mean us document it as part of this. Us
yes,
document
I had,
that.
I made a notation in my notes that we would put something into the procedures that says we don't use that term for these reasons.
Very good. That's all. I think that would be a good idea if we did that.
And then what we say is there is an abstention that's due to obligations that people have that aren't conflicts of interest, but they nonetheless require remedies.
Okay.
Of interest would.
I like that. I like that.
Does that help?
Yes, that helps. I like that idea. Aubrey, are you okay with that?
No.
No? How come?
Still confused. Because I should hesitate to try and speak for anyone else. But if I were a lawyer and I felt I had a conflict of interest due to my situation, then yes, that's not an ICANN conflict of interest, but that still is a Corporation X conflict of interest.
Yeah. So here's
that,
what
that impedes me. So
yeah.
I don't see how ICANN can declare that the only conflict of interest that is a conflict of interest is an ICANN conflict of interest.
Yeah. Well, here's my thinking on this.
I'm confused, sir.
Yeah. So we are doing everything in our power to not use the term conflict of interest. We're skirting around it, right? And there's a reason why we're doing that, because ICANN Legal is taking a position on this term. Fine. That we understand. Okay, let's put in writing, in black and white, what this term is felt to mean by ICANN Legal Advice. Let the IPC lawyers read what this says. And if they defer, now let's bring that forth, that discussion. If the IPC folks or others want to challenge that, that's healthy. That's good. But unless we put it in there, they won't know to do so. That's why I'm thinking it's a good idea. Put it in black and white. What is ICANN's position on this? We as a group, we accept the position by as far as floating it out there. Let others read it. If they have a different opinion, let's bring forth that discussion. If they want to challenge it, then let's do that. But if we just stay silent on it and just try to use different terms, we're avoiding the discussion.
Yeah, Ray, I think that was beautifully said. And you know, to Aubrey, I don't think we're saying that there isn't. If an attorney who is a counselor says I have a conflict of interest, we're not saying that that's false. We're saying, yes, of course, if you say you do, then of course you do. What we're saying is that legal would prefer that we not use the big COI terminology because it has a specific legal meaning that ICANN doesn't want its counselors to be attached to for reasons that it knows. And we can argue with, as Ray said, we can argue with them about whether that should be or shouldn't be true. But for the moment, if we accept it, all we really are saying then is, when you step forward and say, I have a conflict of interest, we're just going to write it down as an obligational abstention. That's all. It doesn't change what happens, and it doesn't change the remedies. It's
exactly.
Just how we what we label it.
Exactly.
That's it.
Exactly.
Okay. As I say, as a person who's not a lawyer and only a philosopher, I'll remain confused and listen to what the lawyers have to say.
There you go. I think putting it in black and white can only be healthy. So that's all I'm asking for. Let's go ahead and use the other terms and et cetera, but let's also just be sure to state what we're saying conflict of interest to mean in the world of ICANN so that people can also understand it like we're understanding it.
Yeah, this is Ken. I got that, and I will put that into this next draft.
Perfect. Thank you. As long as there's no objections. Okay, well, we're about 11 minutes over the hour. I don't have any. Well, there is one other bit of housekeeping, and I don't know who else. I don't think Ron's on the call, but it doesn't matter. I'm going to get it out there for the recording purposes. Yeah. We've been running now for quite a while with really an absent vice chair. It was originally Yov Ternan. Is that correct? But he hasn't participated in any of these meetings now for quite some time. I think it's time we address this. I was going to suggest someone, if they were willing to take on the vice chair role, and I would like that to be Aubrey, if she would be interested. Now, we don't have to make a decision today, but I want to just get it out there. Maybe, Aubrey, you can think about it if you would like to take on that position.
Okay, yeah, I will. Thanks.
Okay. So we'll make that a topic on our next meeting when we have more attendance as well.
Yeah, I'd be interested in hearing what other people thought about the idea of my doing that before I...
I'll float something on the list as well. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Other than that, I don't have anything else to add. And if you guys are willing, we can adjourn and end the call and the recording.
Good talking to y'all.
Thank you, Ray. Okay.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You.